Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell. And today we're going to be revisiting a guest that we had a couple of years ago. His name is Robert Scherer. He's a professor of physics and interested in cosmology. He's also sort of well-known in lay circles because he wrote a very nice op-ed piece for the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago, pointing out that we're really not doing enough to attract young people in the age of the digital telephones into science. And so we're going to pursue that a little bit and go back to talking about dark matter and some of the latest experiments that have been done and some of the latest results that we have. With me today is Russ Chianelli. And so, Robert, you're at the other end of the line, I hope?
Yes, right here.
Okay, well, welcome back to Science Studio, and we look forward to sort of amplifying on where we were a couple of years ago when we did an earlier program.
Sure.
Yes, and also, I see that you write science fiction?
I do.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the science fiction that you write?
Well, I actually started out a while back, and the very first story I wrote was a rather bizarre one. It was it's published in Analog Magazine, which is one of the few remaining science fiction magazines. It was called A Happy Death Day, and it was about a society where everybody knew the day of the year they were going to die, but not the year itself. So when that day rolled around, you had to be extra careful. Most of what I write is sort of, aside from that, is sort of hard science fiction. It's idea-based. I've written one story which centers on my own research area on cosmology. It's a combination of cosmology and baseball.
Oh, boy, that sounds terrific.
It's full of statistics then, right?
Well, no batting averages. Okay.
And I'd like to advertise it. It's on www.cosmicyarns.com. You can look at that, too.
Well, look, before we get into that, though, I'm interested in this Death Day idea, the book that you wrote. Because that sort of rings a bell. There's some statistics I was just looking at. I'm a white Anglo-Saxon male, and I've been told that the actuarial statistics tell me that subsequent to retirement, I've got an average of about 1.7 years remaining in my life. And so there are certain aspects of human behavior, life and death, where death isn't just because you get a disease, per se, but it's also because you've got a mental attitude towards dying, right? Because I can't see that most people dying simply because they've got nothing much to do or their mind goes blank. That I understand, but so therefore the death day concept appeals to me. Give us a brief synopsis. I might go out and buy this.
Well, it was a short story. It's not a book. So
okay.
It was short fiction. It was in the magazine. The plot basically was that there was an alien civilization that was sort of incomprehensible. And I think that's one thing I've tried to do is try to make aliens very alien, because I think if we, in fact, did encounter an alien civilization, it's quite possible we would have no clue what they were talking about.
We might not even know they're there.
Well, that's right. And I think the aliens which were the most alien are the ones that are the most interesting. So this is a sort of incomprehensible alien civilization. As I said, they've been broadcasting everyone's date of death for some reason known only to themselves. One of the protagonists is doing research, and he's basically collating everyone's death day, and he discovers that as you extrapolate into the future, more and more of them are piling up on the same day of the year. And you know what that means?
End of civilization.
The end of the world in the future at some point. And I won't ruin the ending of the story because there's a surprise twist, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not going to tell you anymore. You'll have to dig it out. But that's the sort of plot in a nutshell. It was my first published story. If I had to do over, I think I could probably improve on it quite a bit. I've learned something since I've started writing science fiction.
Did a lot of people read the story? Did you get a lot of feedback?
I imagine. I got some feedback on it. People found it slightly disturbing, interesting.
Movie coming along?
No, I don't. And I'm, you know, if anybody out there wants to make one, I'm available. But I doubt that it's going to be made into a movie. But it's a lot of written science fiction really doesn't lend itself to movies. I think what's interesting is that with special effects improving, I think we're doing a better and better job of bringing stories and written novels to the screen. I think if you look, for example, The Story of Your Life, which was the Ted Chiang film, I think they did a fantastic job of bringing that and making a great movie about it. I'm not sure that could have been done 20 or 30 years ago when we didn't have the kind of special effects to do that.
Well, tell me, were you already an established physicist when you wrote this short story?
Oh, I was. I got into science well before I got into science fiction.
I was very interested in that because, you have to go back and tell our listeners how it was. Did you always have a struggle between writing and science when you were younger?
Well, when I was much younger, and I enjoyed writing, but I thought that it wasn't something you could make a living at, and I'm still not convinced it is. But I knew that I could make a living as a scientist, and I've always enjoyed both science and science fiction. But a lot of people start out reading science fiction, and it gets them interested in science. I think I was the other way around. I really grew up being very interested in science, and then when I encountered science fiction, I think it was a natural fit, and I really enjoyed reading it.
How did your professional colleagues react to your new fame as a science fiction writer?
Oh, I didn't.
Or did
tell
they
them.
Simply say?
I didn't tell them. It's a secret. It's our little secret.
Are you being serious? It's not under your name.
Well, I don't make a big deal out of it, and people know that I'm doing it. But it's as long as I don't confuse the two. As long as I don't start writing rather bizarre papers and claiming that they're science, I'll be okay.
Well, but the bottom line, if I go to Google or different science websites to put in your name, will I come up with the short stories?
You'll come up with about six people who are named with my name who aren't me. There's a dentist, there's a CIA agent who died a few years ago. You'll find a lot of things out there.
Oh, that's actually worth a little short story too. You know,
yeah.
the alter egos of Robert Scherer or Russ Chiarelli or Keith Pannell, you know, I know I've got
kind
one
of scary.
Other. Well, it's scary, but it's sort of entertaining also.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a couple of, 25 Christmases ago, I had the mumps or something. I had something that kept me in the house and none of us could go out. And so on Christmas Day, I just randomly called telephone numbers of different area codes, but my own particular local number, the 7 digits. And that was really entertaining too, talking to all sorts of different people around the country just to wish them a happy Christmas because they had the same telephone number.
Yes.
The things we do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't some of them say, Christmas? What are you talking about?
Well, there was a fellow in New York who was of the Jewish persuasion and said, but we had a lovely conversation anyway.
Mm.
So are you thinking about a science fiction book at the moment?
Well, I'm not sure I have the attention span for it. I'm going to try to write a few more stories this year. I'm on sabbatical this year, and I'm mostly supposed to be doing real science, not spending it writing fiction, unless some people consider my research work to be fiction.
Well, that brings us on to the current state of physics.
Because that's right.
There are a lot of us that really can't quite get our heads around the numbers involved in modern physics. Russ is more into this than I am. So frame a question, Russell, on the statistics, the big numbers of probabilities, improbabilities out there.
Well, I think that one of the things we were talking about earlier here, which I love to talk about, is dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
Because the whole concept of how the universe began and everything involves these things. And
mm-hmm.
we really don't know enough about them. So tell us a little bit about dark matter and what's known.
Well, so we know that dark matter is what binds together clusters of galaxies. So you see these vast clusters of galaxies, millions of galaxies bound together in millions of light years apart. And if there wasn't something extra there to hold them together, they just go flying apart. They're moving too fast to stay together. And then if you look at galaxies themselves, the way they rotate, there's a similar phenomenon. If they didn't have something extra in the core of the galaxy, the matter on the edges of the galaxy would just go flying off into space. So we've known for many years that there's something extra there. And we've actually gotten down to brass tacks and have built very, very large underground detectors to try to find the dark matter. So there's a detector in Europe called the xenon detector, which keeps adding more and more xenon to its underground tanks. There's a detector in the United States called LUX, and the Chinese are getting into it the act. They've named their detector Panda. And they're sort of in a race to the bottom to see who can put the tightest limits on the dark matter. And so far, nobody has seen anything. What they're doing is looking for, you know, tiny, tiny, tiny interactions between dark matter particles shooting through the detector and their detector liquid. And they've been able to put stronger and stronger upper limits on it. But as of today, they haven't seen anything. So that's kind of the status. We're all hopeful they're going to see something in the next 5 years, 10 years, but there's no guarantees.
Well, if they don't find something in 5 to 10 years, does that mean to say that we've really got this whole thing cock-eyed?
It could mean that. Well, there's two possibilities. You know, you look under the lamppost for your keys first. So they're looking in a range of masses that we think is reasonable for dark matter, and a range of masses where we can actually make progress. It's possible that the dark matter is much lighter than what we thought, and it's also possible that it's much more massive.
Of course, I look for my keys where I last think I had them. It's got nothing to do with having a lamppost anywhere close to me.
Well, we're looking, that's sort of the way we're looking for dark matter. We're looking in a regime where we think it's reasonable that it ought to be there, but it is possible that we've got something completely wrong. It's many people have thought that maybe the theory of gravity was simply not quite right, but it's very, very hard to modify Einstein's theory of gravity and not completely mess everything else up.
You're listening to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell with Russ Chianelli and Robert Scherer from Vanderbilt University talking about this particular matter, dark matter. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Hey, Dave, do you know what's responsible for half of all hospital deaths in America?
I don't know. Heart failure?
No, it's sepsis.
Ah, of course. Sepsis is when the body's immune system overreacts to an infection and begins attacking its own organs and tissues.
But it's possible scientists have identified the biomarker that can predict who's at risk of dying from sepsis so doctors can intervene earlier.
Sepsis can be triggered by any kind of an infection, including viruses, bacteria, fungi, and parasites. Very early in sepsis, the immune system produces large amounts of various proteins to ramp up the immune response. One is a powerful process called pyroptosis, which destroys infected cells.
But it also fuels the development of sepsis. When scientists looked for genetic variations that made people more susceptible to pyroptosis, they identified a single change in DNA that creates a molecule called methylthioadenosine, or MTA.
Scientists hypothesized that MTA levels can predict who would die of sepsis, and changing its levels can increase survival. Early in infection, its level in the blood goes up, but falls in tissues. But if an infection isn't dealt with, more MTA is released, which indicates an out-of-control immune system.
Indeed, in 62 patients, the chances of dying from sepsis were increased over 7 times when MTA levels were doubled.
But in their experiments with mice, those treated with MTA before a bacterial infection lived longer. The key is to find out when to raise and lower MTA levels during sepsis to improve survival.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Robert Scherer from Vanderbilt Department of Physics. And just carry on with that sort of a thought process. Well, I think Russell has a question here.
Yeah, I think for the listeners, one thing that led to dark matter was that if you have an explosion which started the universe and all the chunks of matter are flying away as fast as they can, the further apart they get, the whole thing should speed up because the effect of gravity is less as you get the pieces away from each other. And yet, when you looked out at the universe, isn't it true that there's some strange things about the speed at which the universe is expanding and so on?
Well, you're getting into dark energy, which is a somewhat separate topic. If you look at how fast things move away from us, they are, the farther something is away from us, the faster it's moving. That was what led to the theory of the Big Bang. That's Hubble's discovery. But if you look back in time, the expansion should decelerate. Gravity ought to be pulling matter in toward us or any other point in space. So the expansion ought to be slowing down. It's the same way if you throw something up in the air, it slows down and then it falls back down again. But what they discovered about around the late 1990s is that the expansion of the universe at its greatest distances seems to be speeding up. It looks like we've gone through an era where the universe was slowing down the way it ought to, but now it seems to be speeding up instead of slowing down, and that's a rather bizarre result. And so that's why scientists postulated dark energy.
Something that's speeding up and attracting the chunks further out into space.
Well, it's doing the opposite. It's repelling. It's sort of like repulsive gravity.
Repulsive gravity.
We're not used to repulsive gravity. We think gravity always attracts, but in this one instance, it looks like it's repelling.
Well, doesn't that imply that there's a huge infinity of empty space out there?
Well, that's not quite the way the Big Bang works, and it's unfortunate that we coined the term the Big Bang because people think of it as a primeval blob of matter that just exploded. And really, there's no edge to the expansion. The universe is most likely infinite for all practical purposes, and so the universe doesn't really expand into empty space. It fills all of space, and it just expands in all directions. So that's kind of hard to wrap your head around.
And it's certainly very difficult for people who aren't in the game to wrap their head around, right?
I can't wrap my head around it either. It's just the way I use the equations because the equations I understand. If you ask me my intuitive understanding of it, I think my brain is not large enough to contain that.
Is there any possibility that we've got math all wrong?
One hopes not.
Well, I don't. We hope not. And on the simple scale,
I mean, I think mathematics is a logical construction. So, in a sense, you can't get it wrong because you make assumptions, and then based on those assumptions, you can deduce things. It's possible we've got the physics all wrong, and of course, that's always the question: is whether all we need to do is dot a few I's and cross a few T's and just extend our current approach. Or do we need to really completely rethink everything? And I think that's always a question of science. You're never really sure how solid the ground is that you're standing on. You just assume that it's pretty solid.
Well, isn't it also we need to add another dimension here, four dimensions, time?
Well, that's true. And that was, that was Einstein's great achievement, although I'll tell you something I discovered when I was reading science fiction for a course we were teaching here. If you look back at H.G. Wells' Time Machine, he talks about how scientists had discovered that time was the fourth dimension and that you could move through time just like you could move through space. And I had assumed that he was influenced by the theory of relativity. But if you look at the publication date, his book came out 10 years before the theory of relativity. So he was ahead of his time.
Yeah, there was a movie that I remember where the guy goes into space and travels around the planets and he comes back. And his wife is now 30 years older than him.
Uh-huh. That was, I think, a Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly a fascinating subject to think about this, too. And a lot of us sit around and say, I don't want to think about that today. It's too difficult.
So, Robert, tell us exactly what your particular approach to this issue is. I mean, this is something that you study professionally. You are a professor of physics.
Sure. So I'm working on a number of different ideas. The one of the things I try to do is modeling dark energy. So we know that the dark energy is out there. We know that it's very close to what has been called a cosmological constant. That was the proposal that Einstein made right after he developed the theory of relativity. And then he threw it out. And now it's come back, and that would be the simplest explanation for the dark energy. What I've been working on are models that are very close to that, but differ from it just a little bit, and then trying to understand their observational consequences and whether how we would distinguish between those theories and the cosmological constant theory.
Well, I think that that's all extremely interesting, and just to think about the implications of it and what it means for the daily activity. Are we ever going to be able to travel in time?
I would guess not. And the reason is you'd think that if we would, we'd be inundated with time travelers already.
Well,
we're not.
Crowding out all of our... Well, maybe we're just not very interesting people and no one wants to visit us, but...
I also know an awful lot of people with very old-fashioned ideas. I'm not sure that's time travel.
Well, the other thing
thought time travel.
here in El Paso, in this part of the world, there's sort of a magnetic line, and we have more reports of people seeing aliens than anywhere else in the United States.
I think it's the desert, the high desert.
Yeah, right. Well, what do you think about the possibility of life from other planets?
Well, my guess, and it's just a guess. I have no more information on this than anybody else. My guess is that life is probably common, but I think intelligent life is probably rare. And I would base that just on the fact that if you look at the Earth itself, life developed on the Earth almost as soon as it could, almost right after the solar system formed. You get simple organisms on the Earth, and life has moved into every possible niche that it could find on the Earth. But intelligent life, if you consider us to be intelligent life, developed very, very recently. It took a very long time to develop. So for whatever reason, intelligence seems to be something that is not easy to come by.
Well, let's redefine a little. I mean, I've studied, or not studied, but I've thought about and seen and talked to people about ants. It seems to me ants are extremely, as a society, intelligent in the sense that they know how to propagate, they know how to protect, what need be, they know how to move. I mean, that's natural to life.
If we were to travel to another planet and discover talking Star Trek aliens, we'd be thrilled. I think if we just found ants, it would be a disappointment.
Yes, but then we're defining intelligence as something that we possess.
On the other hand,
I'd like to talk to.
If the ants could actually talk to us, that would be also something interesting.
They'd probably tell us to stop squishing them.
Well, I remember a few years ago we did a program. I visited with a bunch of students what was the biosphere over in Tucson while it was still there. I think at the time it was run by Columbia University. But they had a very careful way of looking at what was inside the biosphere. Every species was categorized wonderfully, and then they had different zones. And so they knew exactly what went into the biosphere. But then about 2 years after, they went back to check, and going back to ants, it turns out that the species of ants that were already there when it started, that is what they categorized, they were no longer there. There was another species of ant, completely different to anything that they had seen. And so the question was, well, where did these fellows come from, and why are they so dominant? And it turns out that they were very, very intelligent in one sense, that this particular species that came in on a root of a tree unnoted at the beginning had this capacity to have a chemical factory that was so much more efficient than all the other species of ants. And they could, for example, leave a trail in which there were, let's say, 47 different messages based upon the chemical content of the trail, whereas other ants could only leave a trail with 20. And so the variations of conversation, oh, absolutely go in this direction, you'll find a lot of food. Or, well, you know, 95%, 85%, the gradations, and they just outbeat looking for food all the other species.
So
I think that's intelligence.
Well, you know, there's a very famous short story by Frederick Brown, a science fiction story, in which he postulates that the ants actually are running the world, and they're just tolerating us for the time being.
Well, I mean, I could imagine that. It's just that this concept of intelligence, because we can talk and because we can build instruments that get us from one place to another, aeroplanes, boats, we think that's a sine qua non of intelligence. But looking in my garden and looking at the growth of ant nests, I've got a healthy respect, but we digressed a long way. Tell us then, you're saying you're trying to make other models. Of what particular approach do you use? And do you have graduate students working on this with you, I hope?
Well, I have a graduate student. He's actually working on a dark matter project. But a lot of modeling involves,
math.
Coming up with new ideas about what physical system can generate either dark matter or dark energy. Figuring out what its properties are going to be. And then we usually do a lot of computer simulations. We try to simulate, a lot of the equations that describe how the dark matter or the dark energy evolves are not things you can do with pencil and paper. So you have to put them on a computer and integrate how things evolve with time. And then that gives you your prediction.
By the way, have you ever watched a series called 100 Years?
I don't think so.
It's very, very interesting. It's about 60 episodes, but it's about what happens when the surface of the Earth is wiped out by nuclear attacks.
Oh.
And there's this big space station called the Ark.
Oh, I think I've heard of this, yes.
And it's just how people, different groups, begin to reestablish themselves on the Earth after 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long story, but it's a very, very interesting piece of science fiction because we do worry about nuclear wars.
Yeah. Well, or about how you would reestablish yourself if there was a devastating asteroid impact, anything like that. I'm not convinced that nuclear war is the most likely scenario for an apocalypse.
What would you think, as a good scientist and a science fiction writer, where do you foresee the apocalypse?
Well, I think the most dangerous thing is biological warfare because it requires the resources of a fairly large country to build a nuclear weapon. But I think you can get up to a lot of mischief in your basement with gene editing techniques, and it's just going to get easier and easier and easier. So I don't know how they're going to control that, and I don't like to think about it.
Well, that's now how they're curing cancer with gene modification.
Well, it's as usual. It's something that can do a great deal of good, and it can be very dangerous.
Well, anyway, look, Robert, talking about apocalyptic acts and the futures, we've arrived at the end of the program. You know, this is terrible.
Okay.
And we didn't really talk about anything. It's just actually been a very fascinating conversation.
Oh, yes.
And good luck to you and your writing of science fiction.
Well, I'll try to get back to my blog, too, because I've let it lapse the last couple of weeks after the eclipse. We should have talked about the eclipse. We got to see the eclipse here.
Ah, well.
I was out in the front yard.
I went down to La Paz in about, I can't remember, 86 or something, a long time ago, and saw 7 minutes and 15 seconds of totality.
Wow, that's
which
impressive.
Is getting close. Oh, it was. It was very interesting. But I've got to say, the one thing about the eclipse I remember the best, and this the recent one that we saw, partial, was when you look on the ground underneath a tree. That's the beautiful thing, where you get all these little pinpoint cameras projecting the image.
Little crescents on the Earth.
It's wonderful.
We got our colander out, and we were using that.
Oh, wonderful. Anyway, Robert Scherer, thank you so much for being here from Vanderbilt University. And Russell, thank you for the idea of reprising this gentleman.
Yeah, we hope to have you on again soon. Anytime.
Well,
not too soon.
You know, not too soon. You know where I live, so you can find me.
Okay.
And thanks to Lauren Tarassos, our producer, and thanks to the intelligent designer.
Hasta la vista.